I should also apologize to audience members who saw me give a version of this talk this past spring in Toronto. This talk will be rather similar to that, so I apologize to them for having to suffer through a second iteration. I'll be discussing, after a lengthy introduction, some work done in collaboration with Sheldon Katz, Tony Pantev, Andre Calderaro, and Ron DeNaghi, among others. So what's this work about? In recent years, many physicists have become interested in using derived categories of coherent sheaves as a mathematical model of something called D-brains, which I'll say a bit more about in a minute. Now, you might well ask, what in the devil would drive physicists to consider something like derived categories? One motivation is due to Kontsevich. Kontsevich had an interesting idea for understanding something called mirror symmetry, a symmetry between distinct collabiales, in terms of derived categories, or he made a proposal back in about 1994 that one way to understand mirror symmetry was in terms of properties of derived categories of coherent sheaves on one collabiale and some sort of derived Foucaille thing on the mirror collabiale. And since then, many of us have been interested in trying to understand what the physical content of Kontsevich's proposal for mirror symmetry really is. Another reason why physicists, or why some physicists, are interested in derived categories is that it gives us some powerful new computational methods. We can take difficult physics problems and turn them into trivial math problems, which also means there's not going to be a lot of exciting new mathematics in this talk. There won't be any new exciting new mathematics in this talk. The whole point of this talk will be to take difficult physics problems and turn it into trivial mathematics, where it can be solved very quickly. So as mathematicians, let me warn you now not to be disappointed. A third reason why some physicists are interested in using derived categories is we can use them to help understand quantum corrections to stability of D-brains. This is Douglas's pi stability, and I believe Tom Bridgeland has gotten a paper out of this that actually turns these ideas into solid, honest mathematics. Now, the physical basis of modeling derived categories modeling D-brains with derived categories is still being worked out. And Sheldon and I, of others, have been working for a while on checking some of the physical predictions of this program. And what I'll eventually get to today involves really computing what are called massless spectra, but first I need to explain what a D-brain is. The intuition is that a D-brain is a higher dimensional version of a particle that propagates in space-time. It's some extended object, something with some extra dimensions that can sort of flop around. The notation we use is that a dp brain is an object with p spatial dimensions. So for example, a d0 brain is something that's a point particle. It has zero spatial dimensions, it just propagates in time. A d1 brain is something with one spatial dimension. So at least at the level of this transparency, you would loosely think of it as being like a string. So the physicists in the audience should, well, of course, note that a d1 brain is technically distinct from a string for technical reasons that are beyond the level of this transparency. Now I've been given that very schematic model of D-brains. Let me refine that model very slightly. To lowest order, I can describe a D-brain as a pair of objects, a submanifold of space-time together with some principal bundle with connection on that submanifold. Now there's a lot more to D-brains than this for reasons I'll outline in a few minutes. But for the moment, for the purpose of getting started, this is a nice way to begin. Now I'll assume throughout this talk, I'm going to make certain assumptions on these D-brains throughout this talk. Technically, I'm going to be only working with D-brains in what are called the topological B-model. But what that means in practice is that I'll be assuming the space-time, the ambient space, has a complex structure and a Kähler structure, and usually it has a trivial canonical bundle. I'll assume S is a complex submanifold of that complex space-time, and I'll assume the bundle with connection can be described by a holomorphic vector bundle together with some Hermitian fiber metric, which I'll suppress throughout the talk. The proposal, then, is that this pair of data, a submanifold together with a holomorphic vector bundle on that submanifold, should be well modeled by the obvious sheaf, just to push forward along the inclusion map of the holomorphic vector bundle. That seems obvious enough.
How is the connection used in that?
Oh, the connection appears in the holomorphic structure on the bundle. I can either think about a smooth principal UN bundle with connection or a holomorphic vector bundle with fiber metric. Now, this is a nice, easy example of a mathematical model. And as it goes, it seems pretty reasonable. But the first question to ask is it a good model? After all, when I described D-brains, I didn't tell you about open sets together with local sections defined over that open set. I didn't describe a dbrain in terms of sheaf data. I defined a dbrain in terms of a submanifold with a bundle, and that particular data sounds like it can be described by this sheaf. But is that a good model? Are any physical properties of dbrains encoded in the sheaf description? Since the dbrains aren't defined in a way that's naturally associated with sheaves, you might ask if that's a little bit, you might think that's a little bit fishy. Also, this description of dbrains I've just outlined is very primitive. There's a lot more to dbrains than just a submanifold and a bundle. So, you know, it's very possible that this simple model is a little bit too primitive to capture any interesting physics. How can we check this sort of dictionary? Well, one way, if you're a physicist, is to compare deformation theory of dbrains to deformation theory of sheaves. And if this is a good model, they better match. More generally, you might imagine comparing what are called massless states and open strings connecting dbrains, I'll explain what open strings are in a moment, to X groups between the sheaves. And if all is right in the world, if this is a good mathematical model, these two things really ought to match. As you can tell from this later quote, I've often given this, use these same transparencies in slides for a physics audience. Now, let me explain what an open string is. I'm sure you've all heard by now that closed strings quantize gravity. An open string is topologically an interval, and just as a closed string quantizes gravity, an open string quantizes a dbrain. The endpoints of the dbrain propagate, or the endpoints of the open string propagate on the dbrain. So, for example, right here, I've sketched an open string connecting a dbrain back to itself. Right here, I have an open string connecting two different dbrains, and that this endpoint and this endpoint lie on distinct brains. Excellent question. It doesn't fit into the boundary conditions themselves. What happens, there are two things that go on. First, you have to specify boundary conditions on the string fields. Those boundary conditions just determine the submanifold. Where the bundle comes in is when you describe some extra fields that live just along these boundaries, the so-called Chan-Payton factors. So there are really two things going on. There are two things I need to do to tell you what an open string, tell you about open strings. I have to tell you some boundary conditions to tell you where these boundaries can propagate. I also have to tell you about degrees of freedom that are confined to these boundaries, and it's that latter place that you get the bundle width connection. Now again, mathematically it sounds very natural that dbrains should be associated to sheaves, but let me point out some of the potential physical pitfalls in this sort of thing. Many of the massless states come in an open string and open strings come from certain normal bundle valued Higgs fields that this sort of sheafy model omits. So if I don't include everything, if I don't include all the sources of the massless states, how can we hope to count on everything? Another problem is the normal bundle of the submanifold. Yes, indeed. Another potential problem. Empirically, the way algebraic geometry usually enters physics is in situations when I have a lot of supersymmetry. Now, the trouble is, if I take an open string connecting two generic brains, that open string will break supersymmetry. I'm not going to have all the supersymmetry I would like. Yet, if I have two generic brains, if I have two sheaves, I'd still like to get X groups to count states.
So what is the supersymmetry corresponding geometrically which makes it be broken by such a section?
Explaining what supersymmetry corresponds to geometrically is actually really tricky. I can give you some simple examples. Oh, I can tell you some simple examples. There's a specific physical calculation you can do, but if you're asking for a nice clean geometric picture, some nice mathematical computation, I can't give you such a nice clean mathematical computation. I can tell you what happens in special cases. If I have two parallel dbrains, in the sense that the submanifold defining one dbrain is a submanifold of the other one, if the codimension of the relative codimension is a real multiple of 4, then supersymmetry should be preserved. If it's not a real multiple of 4, then supersymmetry should be broken. The reason why where the 4 comes from is from a physics calculation. If I have two dbrains that aren't enclosed inside one another, but are passing through one another, then at least in simple cases in which both submanifolds are just copies of Rn, and so this angle is constant everywhere, whether or not the brain configuration is supersymmetric will be a function of the relative angle between these guys. Now, taking these sorts of ideas and rewriting them in a mathematically clean framework as, you know, some cohomology calculation or something, I have no idea how to do. And I've never found anyone who could do that. And it's not for lack of trying. Sheldon has asked me the same, very same question a number of times. I guess another point, although it's not mentioned on this slide, although I've, you know, when I've talked about sheaves so far, I've only talked about things that look like push-forwards of vector bundles. There are many more sheaves that don't look like push-forwards of vector bundles. You could well ask, what do those things correspond to physically? We have some basic ideas in a few cases, as I'll be outlining later, but for the most part, we really don't know. That's another problem with this whole thing. When people talk about associating sheaves to D-brains, the correct statement is that given a D-brain, we can associate a sheaf, and in special cases, we can do the converse. But if I want to build an on-shell, if you hand me some generic sheaf, finding a corresponding on-shell D-brain configuration could be tricky. Some other things. If massless states are counted by X groups, then we can make some predictions regarding product structures. Now, what does the product structure correspond to physically? The massless states can be represented by localized operators called vertex operators living on the string. A collision between two vertex operators basically gives us another vertex operator. This gives us what's called the operator product expansion in physics, and mathematically gives us product structures. If I look at boundary-boundary operator products, collisions between vertex operators on the boundary of an open string, morally, those should be encoded by Yonita pairings. If I take two X groups, the Yonita pairing gives me a natural product between them. There are also states that live in the bulk of the open string. In this case, those bulk vertex operators are going to be calculated by a Hausschild cohomology. And so one would like a pairing between Hausschild cohomology and X groups that has to spit out X groups from the physics side of this, and there exists a corresponding mathematical operation, though it's a little bit more obscure. So far, I've discussed three possible checks of a sheafy model of D-brains. I'd like massless states to be counted by X groups, boundary-boundary operator products to be given by the Yonita pairing, and the bulk boundary operator product to be given by, well, another more obscure mathematical operation. If all these statements are true, then this proposed model of D-brains in terms of sheaves seems to be a good one in the sense that I'm able to count to get at physical properties of the D-brains by doing some mathematical computations. Actually, checking any of these statements is a bit harder. Before I outline some of that work, let me make contact with derived categories. This D-brain sheaf model is part of a larger program to model off-shell D-brains with derived categories. Now, I've told you about ordinary D-brains.
Does words mean on-shell and off-shell?
Off-shell means I can have anti-D-brains and tachyons. So, and... Let me explain what those words mean. When I talk about an off-shell D-brain, what I really mean is a collection of objects. It'll contain some ordinary D-brains. It'll contain what are called anti-D-brains. Anti-D-brains are related to D-brains the same way that an antiparticle is related to a particle. They tend to annihilate one another. Now, unlike particles and antiparticles, where there's really just some discrete degree of freedom, like a charge, D-brains have a lot more degrees of freedom. There's some submanifold plus a bundle on the submanifold. And so a D-brain and an anti-D-brain can only completely annihilate each other if all of that data matches, if they live on the same submanifold, if they have the same bundle on the world volume, if everything lines up down the line. If some of the data is a little different, suppose the D-brain and the anti-D-brain live on the same submanifold but have different bundle structures, then when they try to annihilate, they won't completely annihilate, but I might be left with something smaller. So, for example, an easy example of that, suppose I have some D-brain wrapped on all the space represented just by the structure sheaf of the space, and I have some D-brain with a bundle that morally would correspond to an ideal sheaf on that space. There's a natural, well, there are natural maps between these things. If I associate this to an ideal sheaf, I can map that into there. When these two things annihilate, we're going to expect the result to look like a skyscraper sheaf on some divisor on X, where the divisor is determined by the details of this map. This is the So one of these objects, either one can be the brain, the other object can be the antibrain. If I have both brains and antibrains, then I get certain fields called tachyons, which essentially connect the brains and the antibrains. So this has all the structure of just a two-element complex. I have two sheaves and a map. Moreover, the intuition is that when a brain and an antibrain annihilate, then morally you know, after all the dust settles, after you go to low energy and let all the radiation escape to infinity, you expect that the result in a simple case like this should be associated to a skyscraper sheaf on a divisor. So I've basically constructed a D-brain that lives on a submanifold from a brain and an antibrain living on the entire ambient space that have slightly different bundles on their world volumes. Generalizing this is basically the physics. It doesn't have to be. It could just live on a submanifold. The primitive picture of an anti-D-brain is exactly the same as the primitive picture of an ordinary D-brain. It's a pair consisting of a submanifold and a bundle. At that level of description, they're exactly identical. In the same sense that an antiparticle has all the same properties, is essentially just like the particle. It has the same sorts of properties. It has a charge, a mass, all that sort of thing. And for the two of them to annihilate, you want those properties to exactly align. An anti-electron and a proton won't quite annihilate to nothing because they have different masses and whatnot.
What about the two bundles they can annihilate when they come together?
In such a case, if I have, say I have an anti-brain and a brain, and some tachyon map that's just an isomorphism, then I expect these two to completely annihilate. I expect there to be nothing left over after all the dust has settled, after all the radiation has escaped to infinity. I expect that after the system has restabilized, I should be left with nothing. The D-brain and the anti-B-brain should completely kill each other. More generally, if I have a D-brain corresponding to some sheaf and an anti-D-brain corresponding to the same sheaf and a tachyon that's just some isomorphism between them, then again, I expect them to completely annihilate each other. That after all the dust is settled, after radiation has escaped to infinity, I would expect that there to be nothing left.
Is it like the complex structure on the submanifold? One of them has the opposite complex structure, the conjugate complex structure?
It's even dumber than that. In fact, yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. That's exactly it. More generally, if I have some, as you were just saying, if I have some complex. That's right. What I really mean will be, let me come back to that in a second. That will be the content of the next transparency, in fact. The underlying physics conjecture behind all of this is that this process of letting things annihilate and letting radiation go off to infinity, after all the dust is settled, the things you get should be quasi-isomorphic to whatever set of D-brains and anti-brains you started with. It's a conjecture. It's difficult to explicitly check that sort of thing, but it is the fundamental physics conjecture behind this entire derived categories and physics program. But let me come back to that in the next, I think it's the very next transparency that I say something about that. So I can imagine doing, if I have some complex of locally free sheaves, then I can take, as was suggested, all the things with even grading and think of them as D-brains, all the things with odd gradings, think of them as anti-D-brains, and then the differentials in the complex I can associate to tachyons. Conversely, if I set up such a thing physically in the open string B model, it turns out that for consistency of the open string B model, I need for the composition of the tachyons to vanish. I also need for these to be holomorphic maps. There's many more details that can be inserted in here. But this is the gist of how you get to derive categories from what I've said so far. But let me say a little bit more about quasi-isomorphisms, because this is the fundamental point behind how the physics is supposed to work. We conjecture physically that localization on quasi-isomorphisms is realized physically by renormalization group flow. The rest of the story, this business about composition of differentials vanishing, things like that, we can more or less see explicitly inside physics. However, the problem is the renormalization group flow is not something that we can watch explicitly. We can't just do some calculations and, well, in principle, if one had a high-powered computer, I suppose one could do some calculations and watch things annihilate and watch stuff go off to infinity. But as a practical matter, we can't really explicitly watch renormalization group flow. there are some consistency conditions on renormalization group flow. It has to preserve charges, but all that means is the churn characters have to match. If I had D-brains wrapped on some elliptic curve, for example, and let's suppose I had some object in the derived category that was isomorphic to some flat line bundle on an elliptic curve. Physically, the preserving charges doesn't allow me to distinguish a flat line bundle from the trivial holomorphic line bundle. This is a stronger statement than you can get to just from checking charges. One of the goals of what Sheldon and I have been doing is to provide some basic tests of this conjecture to try to see, to try to check that it really is consistent to assume that localization on quasi-isomorphisms really is realized physically by renormalization group flow. So how can you do something like that? Well, one easy thing you can do, it turns out that in these off-shell theories, if I have these collections of brains and anti-brains and tachyons, then at least if all the brains and anti-brains wrap the entire space, computing massless spectra is actually pretty easy, and the result just turns out to be X groups, just as I'm sure you guys have all guessed. Now, we can, if you can also compute the massless spectrum, if I have two objects in the derived category that are quasi-isomorphic individual sheaves, if I can also compute the physical massless spectrum between those on-shell objects and it matches X groups, then I've got some, a nice basic test this sort of conjecture works. On-shell means I have a single D-brain, not necessarily wrapped on the entire space, just one or nice D-brain. And off-shell means I have brains and anti-brains and tachyons and
complex.
Exactly. Off-shell means I have a complex. On-shell means I have a one-element complex. Yes, indeed. Let me say one other little thing. Although I've been talking about, well, not really talking about so much as waving my hands about derived categories and associating tachyons with these maps, there are some slightly more complicated games I can play if I really want to. In principle, there are some additional higher degree maps that I can turn on. For example, I can have degree zero maps mapping, well, degree one maps mapping each of these objects back to themselves. I can have degree two maps backing backwards, degree three maps mapping like this. So really, the objects that you can see in full generality are a little bit more complicated than complexes. What you really seem to get are twisted complexes in the sense of Bondel and Kapranov. Now, I understand the Bondel-Kapranov enhanced triangulated category story relatively poorly, so I don't really want to say anything else about that today. But this fact is sufficiently important.
Two variable maps. These are all one variable maps.
These are
one element and another one. It'll be binary operation.
Not to my knowledge. All right, now that I've given you some general overview of what this whole derived categories program is all about, let me spend the rest of the talk outlining some of the physical details of how you go about calculating massless spectrum. Let me begin with what's called the closed string V model, where computing the massless spectrum actually turns out to be very easy. It's completely trivial. Then let me outline how you do the analogous computation in an open string model, where it becomes physically a lot less trivial. And then, depending upon how much time I have left, I can try to talk about other things. Now, this next transparency was really written for a physics audience originally. Let me tell you what the closed string B model is. The closed string B model refers to a particular type of topological field theory. The field content of the closed string B model is a bunch of worldsheet bosons that encode maps from the worldsheet into some target space, which is always going to be a Clavielle for this talk. Plus, there are a bunch of Grassmann-valued variables, the fermionic superpartners of these bosons. Now, this is a lot of detail you guys aren't particularly interested in. Suffice it to say, we've got a convenient basis in which to work with the B model is as follows, with fermionic variables labeled eta, theta, and rho. And there is a nilpotent symmetry of this model called a BRST transformation, which annihilates the holomorphic bosons and the etas and thetas, but acts less trivially on the anti-holomorphic bosons and on the rhos. There are a few other things I should say about the B model. There are two famous topological field theories in two dimensions, the A model and the B model. The A model localizes on holomorphic maps, and so the A model is all about rational curves, rational curve corrections to this and that. The B model localizes on constant maps, not just holomorphic maps. So the B model in many ways is a whole lot simpler. We don't have to worry about summing over moduli spaces of holomorphic maps into some space. We just have constant maps into the space. For all intents and purposes, the world sheet is a point. There are no rational curve corrections or world sheet instanton corrections in the B model. Furthermore, the B model is independent of Taylor moduli. It's independent of metrics rescalings. All it really cares about is the complex structure of the target space. Now, ultimately, I want to count open string states, which is a bit tricky. So let me warm up by reviewing how one counts closed string states, which is trivial. Closed string states are defined to be BRST invariant combinations of fields. BRST closed combinations of fields modulo BRST exact combinations. Now, from the previous transparency, I told you that the things that were annihilated by the BRST operator were etas, thetas, and holomorphic bosons. So some holomorphic function, you know, basically products of etas, thetas, and holomorphic bosons, is going to give you BRST closed states. Now, in this form, counting states looks a little bit tricky, but Witten pointed out there's a nice way to turn this into math where it becomes trivial. We use the following dictionary. We think of the etas as dz bars, the thetas as ddzs, and then this nilpotent BRST operator we associate with del bar. So these states turn into bundle-valued differential forms on the Clavielle. They're differential forms valued in the nth exterior power of the tangent bundle, where m is the number of thetas. Now, such bundle-valued forms just give us a nice Delbeau-type realization of these sheaf cohomology groups, or Hausschild cohomology, if you're so inclined. So the upshot is that after you do this trivial calculation, you find that the massless closed string spectrum is just Hausschild cohomology. Now, before I can do the analogous calculation of the open string B model, let me remind you how to define the open string B model. I have to give you boundary conditions on the bulk fields, boundary conditions for those etas, thetas, phis, and rhos, and I also need to give you some boundary data, these Chan-Payton factors, that encode the holomorphic vector bundle on the submanifold. The boundary action part is, well, for the purposes of this talk, it's let's just say it's trivial to do. I can simply state the holomorphic vector bundle, and so long as it is a holomorphic vector bundle, then I'm done. The boundary conditions on the bulk fields are a lot more interesting. Naively, they fall into two categories, Neumann and Dirichlet boundary conditions. I can have bosons that are either forced to stick to the submanifold or bosons whose normal derivatives vanish to the submanifold. If they're forced to stick to the submanifold, then that describes an open string propagating along that D-brain partially defined by that submanifold. Now, these are the naive boundary conditions, but there are a couple of subtleties. One subtlety is that this sort of boundary condition was really originally thought out for sigma models in which you weren't so concerned about holomorphy. In order to make sense of statements like this, I really, really want the restriction of the tangent bundle of the ambient space to the submanifold to split holomorphically into the tangent bundle to the submanifold plus the normal bundle. And although that's true for C-infinity bundles, it's not quite true for holomorphic bundles, so these sorts of statements already only make sense in special cases. Another problem is the curvature of that holomorphic vector bundle will distort these boundary conditions. For a line bundle, in fact, the only case in which we really understand how this distortion happens, instead of writing expressions like theta is equal to zero, we get expressions like theta is equal to F eta, where F is the curvature of a connection on the smooth bundle corresponding to that holomorphic vector bundle. And there's a sum over J bars implicit in here, if that wasn't clear. For simplicity, let me assume that neither of those two subtleties happens. Let me assume, for starters, that I have a submanifold such that the restriction of the tangent bundle of the ambient space splits holomorphically. Let me furthermore assume that I have some holomorphic vector bundle with the property that the curvature on its connection vanishes. Then, statements like theta I is equal to zero make sense globally, both because of this reason and because the curvature vanishes. Then, calculating the open string spectrum appears to be easy. It proceeds exactly as for the closed string case. Let me make a few more simplifying assumptions. Let me assume both sides of the open string live on the same submanifold, so I have an open string connecting a D-brain back to itself. The states are going to look like products of etas, thetas, and phis, which are implicit inside here, decorated by Chan-Peyton factors. These are open strings going to connecting a D-brain back to itself, so they're going to couple to two factors of the bundle, or really the dual of the bundle tensored with the bundle. The dictionary to mathematics is straightforward workout. I can associate thetas with DZ bars on the submanifold. The thetas I should associate to the normal bundle. Previously, they were associated to the tension bundled X, but now, since I'm able to think things like theta I is equal to zero for the directions tangent to the submanifold, all that I'm left with is thetas coupling to the normal bundle. And the BRST operator again looks like a del bar operator. Then again, we can associate these sorts of states with bundle value differential forms, counted by these sorts of sheaf cohomology groups, and I don't know that that's quite in focus. Counted by sheaf cohomology on the submanifold, valued in some exterior powers of the normal bundle, as many exterior powers as there were thetas up here, and coupling to E dual tensor F. Here I have a bundle E on one D brain and a bundle F on the other one. Now I need to relate this to X groups. Well, there's a knee-jerk response, but we have to be a little bit careful about it. There is, after all, a spectral sequence that relates the things I got to the things I want. Now, we have to be very careful in applying the spectral sequence. The problem is, the catch is whether or not that spectral sequence is realized physically. So here's one option. If that spectral sequence is not realized physically at all, then I don't care whether or not there's a spectral sequence. The massless states are counted by these sheaf cohomology groups, not X groups, and the result of that would be essentially fatal for this whole derived categories and physics program. We really want massless states to be counted by this. Another option. It means I need to, well, I'll show you a few more details in a minute. What it means is I need to understand there needs to be, what I'll argue in a few minutes is that the massless spectrum calculation I just did was done in a very special set of circumstances in which the spectral sequence trivializes, so these X groups are non-canonically isomorphic to these guys. So the calculation I just did was correct, it only works in the special case if this is trivial. What happens in a more general case is that the correct massless state computation is a lot more complicated, and when you take those complications into effect, the result is that you see X groups hopping out, and the differentials in the spectral sequence are being realized by what amounts to a deformed BRST operator. So counting BRST closed states, modulo BRST invariant states, BRST exact states, is going to give you the same result as taking the cohomology of the differentials in the spectral sequence. That's basically what I'm going to argue. That's basically what I mean by realizing physically the spectral sequence. I guess you don't see spectral sequences realized in physics.
That really just means this mathematical model is consistent with the previous older mathematical model, the BRST theory.
Yeah.
It's just math, really. Math done by physicists.
It's math done by physicists. It's, Well, it's...
Well, I mean, I'm not arguing.
It's just the... But I'm about to say it. What I'll argue in a few minutes is that the differentials here are physical content. Let me show you how that works, or outline how that works, at least in some comparatively easy example. Let's suppose that the restriction of the tangent bundle of the ambient space to the submanifold doesn't split holomorphically, and that the Chan-Peyton factors don't have vanishing curvature. Let's consider a physical state that used to correspond to, would have previously been interpreted as, an element of degree zero sheaf cohomology on F valued in one power of the normal bundle. So one power of the normal bundle means one theta, degree zero sheaf cohomology means zero etas. So I have some state that looks like this. Now the trouble is, since I can no longer make sense of statements like theta I is equal to zero, both because the restriction of the tangent bundle of the submanifold no longer splits holomorphically, and also because of the Chan-Peyton curvature twisting, I can no longer directly associate this guy with an element of degree zero sheaf cohomology on the normal bundle. It's just, schematically, that's there's no direct physical relationship. These guys are no longer counted by these guys. Rather, all I can say is that these guys are going to live in some sort of, they're valued in the tangent bundle of the submanifold, but there's some weird restriction on the coefficients. I can say a bit more, but a priori, that's all it looks like I can say. Now, what I do next is give a very ham-handed description of the co-boundary map in a long exact sequence. Let me give you this little ham-handed description. Let me simply say there's a much cleaner mathematical way to do this in a minute, but hopefully the ham-handed description is basically where the physics is buried. Let me use the short exact sequence relating the restriction of the tangent bundle to the submanifold, to the tangent bundle to the submanifold, to take an element of this sheaf cohomology group and lift the coefficients from the normal bundle to the tangent bundle. If this doesn't split, the cost is that lift will no longer be holomorphic. I'll just have some C-infinity object. If I have a C-infinity object, it will no longer be annihilated by del bar. However, del bar of that lift is now going to be ultimately valued in degree 1 sheaf cohomology, valued in the tangent bundle. This is just the co-boundary map and the long exact sequence associated with the short exact sequence. Once I get something valued in the tangent bundle of the submanifold, I can apply these boundary conditions to turn this tangent bundle factor into a higher degree sheaf cohomology group, giving me ultimately an element of degree 2 sheaf cohomology valued just in endomorphisms of the bundle. So let me state that a little more cleanly. What I've just described is a map from degree 0 sheaf cohomology valued in the normal bundle to degree 1 sheaf cohomology valued in the tangent bundle to degree 2 sheaf cohomology valued in endomorphisms of the bundle. The first map here is the co-boundary map. The second one is application of the boundary conditions. And the physics statement, then, is that I want this composition to annihilate massless states. This composition encodes the combination of BRST invariants plus the boundary conditions, these weird twisted boundary conditions on the open string fields. Now, the catch is this composition is the same thing as a differential in this spectral sequence. So physically now, I want to say kernels and co-kernels of this guy, which is exactly what I want to do to make sense of the spectral sequence. I've only worked through one example and just differentials at one level, but it turns out the other differentials and at other levels in the spectral sequence all have the same form. This is some result of Herb Clemens from the 70s, I believe. Now, taking kernels and co-kernels of differentials in this form isn't quite going to give me X groups. It's only going to give me the associated graded. However, all I really care about today are the dimensions of these guys. And since the groups are all complex vector spaces, there are no finite group factors, so I don't have to worry about non-trivial extensions. And I'm only interested in counting dimensions. I'm going to ignore the distinction between X and associated gradeds and simply state that the BRST invariant massless states are counted by X groups and not some sheaf cohomology group. Now, this sort of subtlety will come back and bite me when I try to make sense of product structures, but for the moment, let me ignore that. Now, all this fun, I've got some examples of this, but I don't think you guys would be particularly excited. All this fun was really just for open strings connecting a D-brain back to itself. If I consider more general cases in which I have an open string connecting two different D-brains, life gets even more exciting. In general terms, again, the massless states appear to have the same sort of form, combinations of etas, thetas, and phis. If I make the same simplifying assumptions as before, that restrictions of tangent bundles to submanifolds split holomorphically and that vector bundles have no curvature, then the main difference is in the possible zero modes I can use to build up these guys. An unstated fact about these computations is that I'm building up the massless states by acting on the vacuum with zero modes. What this means is the phis are going to be confined to the intersection of the two submanifolds, and the etas and thetas are a little more exciting. The etas are now going to couple to the anti-holomorphic part of the complexified cotangent bundle of the intersection, and the thetas are, morally, the thetas are trying to be normal to both S and T. So the cleanest way to express that I know is to say that the thetas couple to the tangent bundle of the ambient space modulo the vector space sum, not the Whitney sum, of the tangent bundle of S and T. Blah. Now, from what I've argued previously, you might expect there should be some spectral sequence relating this myth. I have one factor of this for every possible theta, and factors of ENF from the Chan-Payton factors, and this is all sheaf cohomology on the intersection, you might expect that this mesh should be related to X groups by a spectral sequence, but you can argue no such spectral sequence exists. And the reason is I've forgotten a couple of important anomalies. So there's some very interesting physics that greatly complicates the story, but in the end makes it work out a lot more cleanly. The first bit of physics I've forgotten is something called the Friedewitten anomaly. The pertinent part of the Friedewitten anomaly is part B right here. It says that if I have a D-Brayne wrapped submanifold, such that the normal bundle admits a spin C lift but not a spin lift, the gauge bundle has to be twisted in a particular sense, which they explain at great length. The result for the purposes of today's talk is that when I speak of a D-Brayne corresponding to a sheaf that looks like the push forward along an inclusion map of a vector bundle, it doesn't actually have gauge bundle given by E. Its gauge bundle is twisted. It's given by E tensored with this object I'm going to call the square root of the dual of the canonical bundle of S. Now, that square root actually exists, modulo non-uniqueness, in the case when the normal bundle admits a spin lift. In the case when the normal bundle doesn't admit a spin lift, the square root does not exist as an honest bundle. The right way to think about this is that the Chan-Payton factors, together with the Fapien of a certain worldsheet operator, are together giving you a well-defined object. However, neither one separately is well-defined. So this is shorthand for something more complicated. In any event, the result is that states of the same form, products of etas, thetas, and whatnot, are counted by these more complicated sheaf cohomology groups. I replace each of the original Chan-Payton factors, each of the original E's and F's, with an E tensored, I tensor each E and F with a square root of the dual of some suitable canonical bundle. The result gives me a new factor inside the coefficients of these sheaf cohomology groups, but I still have a problem in that that factor is not an honest bundle.
Is that S intersection T?
That's meant to be S intersection T. I'm going to assume throughout that the intersection is smooth. I don't know how to do the calculation if that intersection is not smooth. These are two smooth submanifolds. I'm going to assume their intersection is smooth. And in a moment, I'll show you something else that I need to make this whole thing make sense. The second anomaly is an open string analog of the Clavial condition. Something, an important feature of the topological B model, of the closed string B model, is that it only makes sense when the target space is a Clavial because of a certain, something called an anomaly in the worldsheet theory. There seems to be an analog for open strings. Anomalies in general, or this
particular?
What this particular anomaly is simply, if I look at the zero modes of the fields on them in a closed string Clavial, what I'm going to get are expressions like, I'll have zero modes of etas, say, but not thetas. So on a Clavial threefold, say, I'll have three sets of zero modes. So in the path integral measure, I'll have 3d etas. In order for the path integral measure to be well defined, I need for this object, I need to make a scalar out of that object. If I have a Clavial, I can contract with the holomorphic tree form to construct a scalar and so make the path integral measure well defined. If I'm not on a Clavial threefold, then there's no nowhere zero quantity I can put here to make the path integral measure well defined. That's basically what how the Clavial condition enters the topological B model. Now, that was just the closed string case. In the open string case, there seems to be an analogous issue. I can go looking at open string zero modes of worldsheet fields in the open string. I find, at least in the simple case, that restrictions of the tangent bundles of submanifolds all split holomorphically, and Chan-Payton factors have no curvature, and so forth and so on, that the analog of the Clavial condition becomes a statement that this weird tensor product of top exterior powers of the normal bundles needs to be trivializable. Now, it turns out that in just such a case, that weird factor I got in the last transparency, that square root of ratios of canonical bundles, turns out to be an honest object when this is trivial. And in fact, it turns out to be the top exterior power of the normal bundle of S intersect T and T, or if I invert this, I'll get in S rather than in T. The upshot now is I finally have some well-defined sheaf cohomology. Combining all of these subtleties now, I get sheaf cohomology valued in E dual tensor F, tensored in the thing I got from the thetas, tensored with this thing that I got ultimately from the Fried-Witten anomaly. And now, finally, there's a spectral sequence taking these guys to X groups. And one can conjecture that the spectral sequence is realized directly in BRST cohomology because of Chan-Peyton-induced twists of the boundary conditions, just as we saw happens when S is equal to T. However, we don't have a general check. We don't have a check of this for in this generality. We don't understand the differentials of the spectral sequence in enough detail to check such a claim. In the previous case, it need not collapse at the third level in general. But what will happen is that all the higher order differentials are all built out of the same pieces. It's all basically diagram chasing involving either applying the boundary conditions or taking that co-boundary map. So what you can argue is, given they all have the same pieces, you can generalize a previous argument in a fairly straightforward way. Let's see, there's some other games you can play with this, but let me move on to something else in the 10 minutes I have left. Assuming I can find it in these transparencies. What I thought I'd talk about next is how you go about associating more general sheaves than just push-forwards of vector bundles to D-brains. Here we go. So here's some basic questions you might ask, given what I've told you so far. I mentioned at the beginning some of the massless states come from infinitesimal deformations of Higgs fields. But the sheaf encodes a submanifold plus a bundle. I haven't said anything about Higgs fields. So how do I possibly get the spectrum right? Another question, not all sheaves correspond to vector bundles on submanifolds. Can you associate D-brains to those guys too? What I'm going to do next is outline how you can, well, to a physicist I would explain this as secretly encoding Higgs data inside sheaves. I think the right mathematical language is Clausel duality, but as a physicist, let me stick to this language. I suppose this language, given that I've got 10 minutes left and this is a math audience, let me skip some of these details. Here's a technical issue which you guys will definitely be interested in. It's lovely to have enough transparencies to be able to pick and choose which are more appropriate for a math audience or a physics audience. Now, I've said that a physical deformation of the D-brain is basically an element of X1 of the sheaf corresponding to the D-brain. So at least in the cases in which the spectral sequence is trivial, that splits up into two pieces. I have, it's not X1 is non-canonically isomorphic in such a case to H1 valued in endomorphisms of the bundle, deformations of the bundle, plus what are called Higgs fields, holomorphic sections of the normal bundle tensored with endomorphisms of the gauge bundle. Bundle deformations, the physical meaning of that is clear. The physical meaning behind this is that these guys move the submanifold. So if I have a D-brain represented as a pair consisting of a submanifold plus a bundle, deformations of that intuitively are a deformation of the bundle together with a deformation of the submanifold. Deforming the bundle is easy. Deforming the submanifold is a little more tricky. I have to drag the bundle along as I move the submanifold. And that's the reason why that spectral sequence I mentioned earlier can be non-trivial after all. It's simply saying that sometimes there are cases in which if I move the submanifold in some directions, I might not be able to consistently drag the bundle along, and so the Higgs fields corresponding to those bad directions need to be omitted from the spectrum. Now, for simplicity in what I do next, let me only consider submanifolds such that that spectral sequence is trivial. Another, for example, such that the restriction of the tangent bundle to the submanifold splits holomorphically into the tangent bundle plus the normal bundle, just so I don't have to worry about those sorts of details. Now, how do you encode Higgs vez and sheaves? This is something I learned from Rondonagian, Ein, and Lazarsfeld's excellent paper from many years ago. If I think about a Higgs field as being a holomorphic section of the normal bundle tensored with endomorphisms of the gauge bundle, then I can think about this as, well, Hams from the conormal bundle into endomorphisms of the gauge bundle, or basically I can think about these guys as defining a deformation of the module corresponding to the sheaf. I can think about these guys as allowing me to define a deformation of the module corresponding to the sheaf. I take elements of the ring of algebraic functions that annihilate the original module, so I mod I squared, and use the Higgs field above to define a new action of these elements. Instead of annihilating these modules, I'm now going to get some endomorphism of that module. The result is some new sheaf inside the total space of the normal bundle. And it's a lot easier to do this in examples than it is to explain this. Now this is nice mathematics. This is going to give me a way to take a Higgs field and construct some new sheaf. But you could well ask, does it have any physical content? Just because I've got some nice math doesn't mean that math will necessarily be realized in physics. Now what I'll do to check this is calculate open string spectra and dbrains with Higgs fields, and check that the open string spectra you get from the physical computation really do match X groups between the corresponding sheaves. Let me do a couple of trivial examples in the 5 minutes I have left. Actually, I'm going to take just a minute and explain what I mean by counting open string states. A Higgs field is going to correspond to a state like this. I give it a VEV by adding to the world sheet theory, adding to the path integral, a factor that looks like this. The effect will be to deform the BRST operator. It'll no longer be associated just with a del bar. It's going to look like a del bar plus phi 1 theta I minus phi 2 theta I, where the phi 1s and phi 2s are Higgs VEVs on either end of the open string. I can't do this for any old set of phis. There are some restrictions imposed by supersymmetry and topological invariance. The phis have to be holomorphic, and they have to commute with one another. The result is that open string spectrum, in these good cases, in which I still have supersymmetry preserved and whatnot, are just given by the cohomology of this more complicated operator. Here's a completely trivial example of this in action. Suppose I have a D0 brain on the complex line. So this is just a skyscraper sheaf on the complex line. It's going to have one Higgs field. Let's give it a VEV. So I start with a skyscraper sheaf at the origin of the complex line corresponding to this module. Let me describe this as a generator with relation. Turning on a Higgs field is going to deform that relation. Instead of letting X annihilate the generator, I'm going to say X multiplied into alpha is phi times alpha. So now X minus phi annihilates alpha. So the result is the new skyscraper sheaf just translated by phi. So giving a field a Higgs VEV has moved the sheaf, which nicely dovetails with the physical intuition that Higgs fields should move the submanifold. And when you compute open string spectrum, there's a nice match. I'm running very short on time, so let me not work through any of these details. Let me just mention in brief some other games you can play. If you have nilpotent Higgs VEVs, you can generate non-reduced subschemes of space-time. And in fact, the physical computation gives a fun way to calculate X groups between structure sheaves of non-reduced schemes. It just turns into linear algebra. Since the physical open string spectrum computation just involves taking the cohomology of this operator, if I have non-reduced schemes supported at points, the del bar operator becomes trivial. So I'm just looking at cohomology under multiplication by matrices. It's very easy. And since I'm now just about out of time by my watch, let me summarize by saying one can prove that open string spectra, that the cohomology of this operator will always match, X groups between these sheaves, at least subject to the technical restrictions I imposed at the beginning, that restrictions of tangent bundles to submanifolds split holomorphically. In those special cases, X groups between the sheaves obtained by this sort of Higgs deformation construction always do match open string spectrum. So this abstract construction of sheaves from Higgs fields does in fact have physical content in the sense that it does correctly give open string spectra from X groups. In conclusion, let me just say that there are a number of open problems yet in understanding the physics behind the derived categories program. I've spent the last hour outlining how you do massless state computations, but product structure computations are another level of difficulty beyond this. They're a reason why I didn't mention them today. They're much, much more difficult to do, and if anyone's interested, I can explain in length some of the interesting complications that arise. There are many other aspects of this as well that would be nice to better understand. Since I'm now, by my watch, I'm now out of time, let me stop there.